From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're revisiting the incredible story of Melvin Dumar. Dumar says in the dead of winter, 1967, he found the reclusive billionaire Howard Hughes on a dirt road in rural southern Nevada. He gave him a ride to Las Vegas and was rewarded years later by being included in Hughes' will. Well, Dumar died earlier this month, so we'll talk about the story with someone who believed it. Join us after this.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. A lot of people want to know, does Doug really read all those books? The answer, yeah, he does. No one really knows how, but we do know that he gets up very early. If you want to try keeping up with him, you can buy the book by clicking on the indie bookstores, Amazon, or Audible links at the bottom of the episode page. If you do, some of the proceeds go to support Radio West. So thanks for that, and thanks for listening. Here's the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Melvin Dumar has died earlier this month. And I wonder, does the name sound familiar? In the 1970s, Dumar and his story became kind of a meme before there were memes. He claimed in 1967 he rescued the reclusive billionaire Howard Hughes from a deserted dirt road in southern Nevada in the middle of winter, in the middle of the night. And that was the reason, he says, he had been named in Hughes' will. Now, the will made national headlines when it ended up at the headquarters of the LDS Church in 1976. Hughes, or whoever had written it, had left a lot of money to the church. Those of us in Utah knew about the story because of the church part and because Dumar was a Utah, a lapsed Mormon who had a gas station in Willard. That's actually where the will apparently first appeared. Now, the document was ruled a forgery, and Dumar never did get any of the money, but he stuck to that story all his life. Today in the program, we're going to revisit it with the former FBI agent, Gary Magnuson. Magnuson has written two books about his investigation of Howard Hughes' death and his will, and he believes Dumar was telling the truth. You're also going to be hearing tape from Dumar himself. This was collected by our producer, Benjamin Bombard, who went to see Melvin Dumar in 2011 to produce a radio piece. We'll hear from Benjamin a little bit later in the program as well. Gary Magnuson served as an FBI agent for 26 years. His books are Stolen Justice and The Investigation, and he joined us yesterday from his home in St. George. When you learned about Melvin's death, Gary, just tell me how you were thinking about that, what you thought about it at that time.
Well, of course, I knew that he was suffering from very serious cancer. I spoke to him about a month before, and I could tell that he was not doing well at that point. But essentially, Melvin is an ordinary guy, a workaday guy. Mm. All his life, he did his best, he loved his family, and was actually thrust into a situation because of this, the will and so on, where he was looked upon by much of the public as a scammer and a person that could not be trusted, and it affected much of his life because he had difficulty getting a job and so on and so forth. You know, it was tough.
It's interesting. You say in your book that in the end, it's a tale of two men. One, a regular guy, as you say. The other, a man of great achievement and wealth. Say a little bit something about that. I think that contrast is interesting.
Well, of course, Howard Hughes was a very famous man at the time in the United States. He was the first American billionaire. He had developed a lot of various types of airplanes and so on. He had flown around the world in record time in one of his airplanes. He was a movie producer, made a lot of different movies. He had a number of businesses where he made a lot of money and was very influential. And then, of course, Melvin, he was just a regular guy that stumbled onto this man in the desert in 1967, and it changed his life forever.
How do you describe your relationship with Melvin? You were skeptical at first when you met him. You came to believe his story. You came to the story again later, even after it seemed like it was over. How do you describe your relationship, and how do you describe your attachment to that story?
Well, when I first sat down with Melvin, I think it was sometime in 2002. I approached it as a skeptic because all I really knew was what I had heard in the media, and I really thought the story that he told was pretty far out there. But at the time when I first met him, he had cancer at that time, and he thought he was going to die because it was very serious. And I thought to myself, well, why is this guy reopening this wound? Why now, if he's going to die, why should he care? And so I thought, well, maybe he's sincere. Maybe he did find somebody, but it probably wasn't Howard Hughes, and so on and so forth. But he asked me to please look into it, and I did. And as I continued looking and finding new information, I began to think, well, maybe there's something to this story.
In December of 67, on the 29th of December, I left Gabs in the evening time. I think I must have left there somewhere around 11 o'clock. That was a payday, and like most of the miners, I lived from payday to payday. I was driving south toward Las Vegas, went through Goldfield, past Lindy Junction, where the notorious Cottontail Ranch is located. I was about 5 or 6 miles south of Cottontail Ranch, and I had to stop and relieve myself. It was just going to pull off the highway, but then I seen a little dirt road that went off the highway. And there in the dirt road was a man lying. Thought I'd found a dead body. It appeared to me like somebody had dumped him there. He had blood on his face and on his shirt. Real baggy pants, looked like they were about 4 sizes too big for him. He had a kind of a beige-colored long-sleeve shirt on, no coat, no hat, nothing, you know. Being the 29th of December, it was quite cold out. I stopped the car. I was contemplating whether I should go get the sheriff or something. But then I seen him moving. I got out and helped him up and put him in the car. Wanted to take him to a hospital. He said no, he didn't want anything to do with doctors or hospitals or police or anything. He wanted to go to Vegas. I said, well, I'm going down to through Las Vegas. For the first while in the car, he just kind of trembled, you know, quite violently, you know, he's shaking and everything. He was curious about who I was and what I was doing, and I told him about being in the Air Force, and I wanted to be a pilot and all that, and they wouldn't let me be a pilot because I didn't have a college degree. But I tried to get a job at Hughes Aircraft, and that's when he told me that he owned it. He was Howard Hughes.
You say in your book that part of this was just that it was fascinating. I mean, as a story, it was fascinating. But you also say you wanted to lay out some facts for the court of public opinion. That was another part that was really important to you. Just explain why that was so important to you. I guess as an investigator, a law enforcement officer for so many years, that was really important to you.
Yeah, once I began to think that there was something to his story, I also understood that he had been defamed in the press. He had been called a fraud and a liar and a crook, and it had really affected his life negatively. So I thought, well, if this is true, I'd like to make it right, at least give him a chance to tell his story and let the public see all of the facts so that they can determine whether or not he was telling the truth.
You know, I have to say, before I encountered your story about all of this, it was hard to believe Melvin Dumar in some ways, and I wanted to ask you why that was. Is it just the way he was portrayed, or was his own kind of eccentricities about his own personality, is that what made it in some ways difficult? I mean, you talk about in the first book, you know, he performs in this cabaret act with a satin bodysuit. He talks about his music dreams. He has this obsession with TV game shows. You know, he had been arrested for shoplifting. He has this kind of dicey background, and that seems like it's hard to believe this guy. So he's a challenging figure in that way, I think.
Absolutely, I agree. He was, and like I say, I was skeptical initially and for some time after that, because there were so many things. You know, it was a real challenge. Now, I go into any investigation with an objective view. I don't take either side until the facts begin to pile up.
Have you grown tired of this story, Gary? Are you tired of talking about it?
Well, yeah, in a way. I mean, I've two books and dozens of interviews, newspaper and radio and even on TV. And I'm not really tired of it, but it's as far as I'm concerned now, it's past, you know. It's over and done. He's gone. I think I rehabilitated him. I know after all of this came out, there were a number of people that said that they had changed their view of Melvin, and he also felt much better about things at that point.
After the first book, The Investigation, you did keep at it, and you continued exploring the case. Say a little bit about that next step in the story, because you talk about how after you were getting some publicity and, a lot of people like us were paying attention to that story, that tips began to flow in. Any new evidence, any new insights that came to you in that second part of the exploration?
Yes, a number of witnesses came forward. You know, it's a funny thing. With the passage of time, sometimes people are more willing to talk about things that happened in the past, and that's exactly what happened. I began getting phone calls from people that helped develop the story. The party line for the Hughes Corporation, those that ran the corporation, and those aides that were around him, and the only people in the world that actually saw him face to face, except those that had seen him outside of the DI, was that he never left. He moved into the Desert Inn in Las Vegas in November of 1966, and their story was that he never left until he actually left Las Vegas in November of 1970. So there were a lot of other witnesses now that came forward, and that filled out the story, as far as I'm concerned, and verified exactly what he had said.
It's interesting that when you write about what you call a Hail Mary pass to try to get... It was 28 years after the initial ruling by the jury that, in fact, it was their opinion that Howard Hughes had not written that will. But you go back at it. You try this story. You had a glimmer of hope, you say. Talk a little bit about those moments. This was November of 2006, for example, in Salt Lake City. And it was an interesting time, I think. You mentioned Mayor Rocky Anderson, mayor of Salt Lake City at the time, wished Melvin Dumar good luck.
Yeah, he did. He did. Of course, when the trial, the probate trial, the longest probate trial in American history, right, took place shortly after Howard Hughes' death, and it lasted 8 months, and they had all kinds of witnesses and so on, but essentially what it was Goliath against David, because those that fought against the will had all the money that they needed and number of lawyers and so on and so forth, and came down very hard on the will. But in the end, in speaking with some of the jurors in the case, it came down to whether or not Howard Hughes ever left the Desert Inn during that time period.
Right.
If he didn't leave, then all of this would be a lie and all of it would be contrived. If he did leave, then it could have happened. And so that's the way it ended up. And unfortunately, it wasn't really he that lost the trial, because he was only a witness in that trial.
Right, right.
But they found that the will was not a legitimate will, even though they had handwriting experts against the will and just as many handwriting experts for the will. So that was kind of a wash. But there was so much else that took place in that trial. It was obstruction of justice. There was perjury. There was witness intimidation. All of this that I developed once I got into the investigation. And so I feel as though that trial was a sham.
I had a Western band, and I was playing at a church singles dance down here in Riverdale, Utah, the night they came back with the verdict. I think it was one of the guys from KSL, Channel 5, that told me that the verdict was in and that they'd found against the will, and said that they felt that someone other than Hughes had written it. And the jury said that why they went against us is because there wasn't any evidence at that time to show that he was out. I was kind of expecting it, but I was really hurt and devastated. And I know I just left the dance. I left and went home.
What'd you do?
No, I don't know, just kind of beat up on the wall a little bit. Yeah, I was upset, but I don't know. I just tried to get away.
You mentioned Judge Bruce Jenkins ruled the matter. He was one of the judges that ruled the matter closed. This was after your attempt to get it reopened. And one of the things that the judge said was that he understood there may have been fraud. It seems like he believed there had been fraud in that initial trial, but that Dumar's attorney hadn't appealed the ruling, and now it was too late.
That's correct. You have to remember that after that 8-month trial, they were essentially exhausted. They had no more money to pursue this thing. They were down and out, and although he should have appealed it, there's no question about that, it wasn't done. And Melvin had no position to do it. He didn't have any money or anything. And so that's the way it ended. And unfortunately, in our criminal justice system, the little guy often doesn't get the justice that he should.
Mm. Do you think Howard Hughes tried to reach out to Melvin before he died to thank him before he got as he says, he received the handwritten will there in Willard? Do you think that Howard Hughes tried to reach out before all of that?
Yes, I think he did. On at least one occasion, Melvin had given his car to his then-wife, and she worked in a casino in Las Vegas. And one day when she came out to get in the car, there was a note left there saying that Melvin should go to such and such a bank. There was something for him there. Unfortunately, she threw the note away, and Melvin was never able to follow up on it. And even so, he thought that was a joke and really would not have taken that too seriously. So I think at that point, Howard Hughes was trying to reach out to him and help him out financially at that point.
It does reveal something about Howard Hughes. I have to say, this was an interesting insight in the latest book. You say that there are a lot of reasons for Howard Hughes's kind of sad and pathetic decline in his later years. You know, this germophobia, there's some talk about dementia. But you say it's also possible that his behavior was the result of what you call the negative effects of his genius. Maybe say something about that. I thought this was an interesting point.
Well, you know, it's a proven scientific fact that many geniuses, those who have incredible intelligence, also have a kind of a dark side to them. Sometimes they're very depressed. Sometimes they have delusions and so on. And so it's a two-edged sword in a way. They are a genius in one respect, but they have these dark angels at the same time. And I think he also had that. Another factor was that he died of acute kidney failure. And so one of the symptoms of kidney failure is that the kidneys do not clean the blood as well as it should, and so you have these toxins in your body. And oftentimes that affects a person's mind because at one point or another the toxins are quite strong, and so they're not able to function. At other times, it seems to be better. And I think that's really one of the factors that also was into why he was the way he was. He also was addicted to codeine.
Yeah.
And required shots of codeine every day. And so all of these factors build up and made him a recluse, made him very erratic in his behavior and thoughts and so on.
What was Howard Hughes doing in the desert? We've talked about this before with that. I think you mentioned that there's the story of he went out there to look at mines, land that he owned. That was one part of it. The other part of it, of course, is that he had an affection for a woman, Sunny.
That's
I wanted you to talk about that part, too, because that I thought this was kind of touching, that he was looking for affection in those late days, looking for love or something.
Yes. He all his life, he had loved women. But he was such a recluse that he didn't really have any relationship with any women in those last years. But he did go to a couple of brothels, and the pilot that flew him to those brothels has provided significant information and details about that. But the night that Melvin found him, it was on the 28th of December, 1967, he found him about 7 miles south of the Cottontail Ranch. Now, if you are familiar with that territory of western Nevada, it's absolutely barren. There's nothing there. And the Cottontail sits out in the middle of nowhere, quite a distance from the nearest town. And the man was attempting to get up but couldn't. It was a cold night, and so Melvin got out and picked him up. So this was 7 miles south of the Cottontail Ranch brothel. And evidence shows that he visited this woman by the name of Sunny on several occasions at the Cottontail Ranch and met with her there a number of times. Subsequent to my last book, I have identified this Sunny.
You have? Wow. Do tell.
Yeah. Yeah. Her name was Betty McDonaghy. She was from Muncing, Michigan. And she passed away in 1989 in Las Vegas. And I spoke with her son. He said that she was really removed from the family. She had left early in his life. He didn't really know her that well. She was bipolar, and she led a very troubled life. He knew that she had gone to Nevada. He wasn't sure why. But, so now I have her identity as well.
Wow. It's interesting, isn't it, Gary? These pieces keep coming to you. I'm not sure if you're still looking for them, but one layer upon layer. It seems like this has never stopped.
No, it's amazing, and I don't anticipate writing any more about that. But I thought it was amazing that I was able to find out who she was. I got a call. A man from Muncing, Michigan said, I think I know who her son was. And so I worked from there and was able to establish it. And I got a photograph of her and compared it against the photograph that the pilot, Robert Darrow, had given me. He had taken a photo of her some years earlier. When Howard was visiting her, and those two photographs are absolutely identical, and there's no question that it was her.
It's Gary Magnuson. He's a former FBI investigator, and he has two books about the Melvin Dumar Howard Hughes story, The Investigation and Stolen Justice. You can find out where to get a copy of any of those books on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Have you added a new smart speaker to your home? They're amazing, right? In fact, you can make your Amazon Echo, Google Home, or Apple HomePod even smarter. Ask it to play KUER. Your digital assistant will serve up our live stream filled with the latest news and brain-expanding shows like Marketplace, Radiolab, and All Things Considered. To find out more about how to use your smart speaker, go to KUER.org and click on How to Listen. Or just tell your device to play KUER.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're revisiting the incredible story of Melvin Dumar. Dumar says in the dead of winter, 1967, he found the reclusive billionaire Howard Hughes on a dirt road in rural southern Nevada. Says he gave him a ride to Las Vegas and was rewarded years later by being included in Hughes' will. Well, Melvin Dumar died earlier this month, so today on the program we're talking with former FBI agent Gary Magnuson, who has looked into Dumar's story. He's written two books now, building a case that Melvin was telling the truth. You know, a question I've always had is, why is it? It seems like the trouble for Melvin started when that will was delivered to him, as opposed to delivered to the Mormon Church. It came to him first, as we've talked about. And I've always wondered, why do you think that is? Why did they deliver it, this Forsyth character that you write about? Why did he deliver it to Melvin first, before the Mormon Church?
Yeah, it is a strange situation. I think there was someone behind that delivery, and I believe his name was John Meyer. He was an employee of Howard Hughes. He's the one that acquired all those mines for the Hughes Corporation in western Nevada. And why he decided to tell Forsyth to deliver the will to Melvin, I cannot answer that question. I don't know. I've spoken to Meyer about it. He is very closed-mouthed, would not really give me much information except the fact that he did absolutely confirm that Howard Hughes had been out of the Desert Inn. But yeah, when that will was delivered to Melvin, of course he didn't know it was a will, it was an envelope.
I had a little gas station, a little mini market in Willard, Utah. A guy came in to the station. I didn't know who he was or where he came from. I was had some school books open, and he just kind of almost snuck up on me. He started talking to me, asking me about Hughes and who I was and if I'd ever met him. You know, I thought that was strange because it was only a couple of weeks after he died. I told him about, you know, well, I picked up some bum a few years before that that said he was Hughes, but I didn't, you know if it was him or not. The lady came in to the station, and so I excused myself to go wait on the lady. After I got finished with her, he was gone. I didn't even see him leave. After everybody was gone, I went back and was going to, you know, do the schoolwork I was working on. And there was that envelope laying right on my books. I picked it up and I thought, what the heck is this? I knew this guy was the only one that was in there, so he had to have left it. But he didn't tell me why or anything. It was addressed to David O. McKay, who was the president of the church. But at that particular time, I don't think he was the president anymore. I think he'd passed away and there was somebody else. Even though I was raised Mormon, I wasn't that active, and so I wasn't even sure who the president of the church was at that time. My curiosity is I wanted to see what it was all about and, you know, and why it ended up with me. And so I went and opened the envelope, steamed it open, and read it, and it scared me to death.
And so he didn't know what to do. He resealed the envelope and then delivered it to the Mormon church in Salt Lake City.
A couple of days later, I heard on the radio that a mysterious woman had delivered a will, purportedly Howard Hughes's, to the Mormon church office building. I just thought, well, you know, if they think a woman delivered it, I'm just going to go with it, because I thought somebody at that particular time that somebody was trying to pull a joke on me. I didn't know if it was real or if it was fake or what the heck was going on, and I didn't know who the guy was that brought it to me, and there was just a lot of unanswered questions, so I felt that it would be easier for me if I just went along with the notion that a mysterious woman had delivered it. So, and it was mainly because I was scared to death, and I didn't want to be responsible. I didn't want to be accused of writing it, which I knew I would.
There are so many strange things with this the whole case that some of the questions are not answerable.
Yeah. You say that all of the evidence pertaining to the Hughes probate trial you found out had been destroyed. Why do you think that is?
I don't know. They have the clerks of the court to have various jurisdictions have rules on keeping the evidence of a trial, and if they didn't destroy it from time to time, it would probably fill up many, many warehouses. And so they destroyed most of that stuff. Initially, they told me that the will had been destroyed as well.
It was a three-page will of Howard Hughes written on yellow legal paper. After my death, my estate is to be divided as follows. First, one-fourth of all my assets to go to the Hughes Medical Institute of Miami. Second, one-eighth of my... I didn't know what to do with it. Third, one-sixteenth to go to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. David O. McKay. I took it out several times and reread it. I couldn't believe what I was reading. 8/116 to go to Melvin DeMar of Gabs, Nevada.
And your name is spelled misspelled.
It's spelled wrong.
But I kept checking and finally found the right person in at the Clark County Clerk of Courts, and she said that the will still existed and it was kept in a safe in the courthouse there. So, but she would not allow me to look at it. She said it was under seal. I guess they presumed it had some historical value.
Yeah.
But I do have an exact copy of the will before it was processed for fingerprints. The original will is smudged and stained because of the fingerprint processing. But I do have the will, a copy of the will prior to that processing. And it's one of those things, that bits and pieces,
Well, you also raised the intriguing possibility, if in fact the will still exists, is there a possibility of doing some DNA analysis and finding out this is in fact the DNA from Howard Hughes? Making that connection to Hughes would be crucial.
Absolutely. And the FBI processed those three pages, and although they were not able to find fingertip impressions, they did pull up palm prints and partial prints from the hand, but there were no palm prints on record from Howard Hughes, so they could not be compared. And of course, if you are writing a document, a piece of paper, you oftentimes lay your palm down on it to hold it in place as you're writing, and I believe that's what it was, and that would have probably left some DNA on there. And I tried everything I could think of to get them to just allow us to process the DNA on there, and they declined to let me do that. We could then have compared it against all of the other handwritten memoranda that Hughes had written over the years, and we would then have a comparison of the DNA from those memoranda and the will, but it was not to be.
We mentioned this earlier, that you said you wanted to lay the facts out there for the court of public opinion. Looking back, you've put the facts out there now. Do you feel like it's made a difference in you said you wanted to help Melvin's reputation. That was important to him. He told you that first thing, that it was important. Do you think you have?
I think so. I've spoken to a number of people that say they've changed their mind about Melvin as a result of it. And on one occasion, one of his grandsons came up to me and personally thanked me for helping his father. And that was quite satisfying. You know, I didn't start this process to rehabilitate Melvin. Mm-hmm. It developed that way. And once I was convinced, then, yes, I wanted to rehabilitate his reputation, and I think I did.
Did you think of yourself as a friend of Melvin's in the end? And what were your conversations like? Were they just two friends talking, or were you still talking about the case? Did you talk about anything else?
No, it was just regular stuff. He stopped by my home here some time ago, and we talked out in the yard for a long time. It was just regular stuff, how he was doing, what he was doing, and so on. The last time I spoke to him, he confirmed that he was telling the truth, and he would go to his grave knowing that he had told the truth.
Yeah. Well, he did, didn't he? Went to his grave with that truth, as he said.
Yeah. There are still scoffers, of course. There always will be. But if you compare what they have to say with the facts in my book, it becomes very evident that I have the evidence and they just have speculation and basically rehashing the party line that he never left the desert in.
Let me ask you this finally. Are you finished with this story, do you think? It sounds like you want to be, but are you finished with this story?
Well, I think so. I mean, when I was finally able to identify this Sunny woman, that was kind of the end of it for me. I'm finished with it. I can't imagine what else would come up now to reopen the thing.
Does that make you relieved, or does that make you a little sad that it's over?
No, it's like a lot of cases I investigated when I was an FBI agent. When they were over, they're over. And I, we filed suit in federal court in Salt Lake City and in Las Vegas to try to reopen the probate matter, because we were confident that if it had gone to trial again, we would have been able to really prove the will to be legitimate, and that Howard Hughes actually was out of the Desert Inn. But so much time had passed, and the judge ruled that if there had been a fraud committed, it should have been appealed right after the probate trial. But it is what it is, and life goes on. I've written a couple of more books since that time, and so life goes on.
Benjamin Bombard is one of the producers of our show. He went and talked to Dumar a few years ago, and he's joining us now. Why did you go talk to Melvin Dumar? Tell that story. What got you thinking about Melvin Dumar?
Well, it kind of started with this show, actually. So when I was an intern on Radio West, like a lifetime and a half ago, Gary Magnuson's book, The Investigation, came across our bow, and we had him on the show to talk about it, and I was an intern who helped production on that show, and it just seemed like an uncanny, kind of a distinctly Utah story. I don't know what it is about this place. It seems to attract a lot of eccentric stories, and Melvin was part of that. And then years later, I was working up in Jackson Hole, and I'd made a friend along the way, Nick Vanderkolk, who produces a terrific podcast called Love and Radio.
Yeah.
And he was just getting ready for the second season of this podcast. And he reached out to me and he said, "Hey, there's this guy, Melvin Dumar. Have you heard about the story?" I was like, yeah, I have. I've helped produce a radio show about it already. So he said, "I want you to go and talk to Melvin and get his story for the podcast." And being already familiar with it, it was kind of nerve-wracking to go meet the man, because I didn't know exactly how I felt about it still.
You felt skeptical?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
a lot of people did.
A lot of people did.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I went down and I talked to him.
When you met him, first impression, what did you think of Melvin Dumar?
Melvin Dumar was like a lot of people I'd met growing up in Utah.
Huh.
He seemed, as Gary said, he was kind of a regular guy, just a regular Mormon guy, quite honestly. Lived in a one floor, pretty large spread house in Brigham City with fields all the backyard and looking out towards the Great Salt Lake and rickety fence that you had to go through to get into his house, and sat on a big couch in front of a big TV. And he was a really friendly, simple, welcoming, and credulous guy. There was something about him that made me want to believe him.
Yeah.
Because he was so sure of what had happened.
Yeah.
And I think when you encounter that, you know, your BS detector is on. Of course, as a journalist, you're looking for the holes, you're looking for contrary statements, and you're looking for places where the story doesn't match up. But there was none of that. He was into game shows and stuff. He wanted to be on game shows. He was just a simple, friendly guy.
Did he seem world weary or wounded or angry or regretful? I mean, was there anything kind of wistful or sad about him, at least when you first see him or encounter him?
No, he was jolly.
Really?
He was a pretty jolly guy. He laughed a lot. And where the wistfulness, I think, did come in was when he talked about what effect this story had on his life. He wishes, he told me, that he'd never found Gordie Hughes. He wished he'd never driven down that road and found that man lying in the road and picked him up. It just brought him nothing but pain and suffering.
Yeah, and cost him a lot of money, he said.
Cost him a lot of money, cost him a lot of time, and people were pulling knives on him and stuff. He got held up a couple times, but it wasn't a good thing for him. And for a man, a simple man, who'd just gone through his life and tried to be good to his family and do his, he loved making music. He sang out at bars in Reno and stuff and wrote all his own tunes. To stick to a story like that for that long, why would you do that? I don't know why you'd do that.
Yeah.
Just come out and say it. Just at a certain point, especially these days, there's a lot of stories that don't hold up. And people can face up to those stories, and you eat some crow, and then you back down. I'm sure Melvin Dumar wasn't unfamiliar with eating crow in his life.
Yeah.
And this is a crazy enough story that if he'd backed it off of it, people said, yeah, you made up a crazy story. We wish you hadn't, but you did. But he never changed his story.
Yeah.
He never changed his tale.
He sang you a song that he had written for Howard or about Howard.
Yeah, he didn't want to.
Really?
Yeah, no. He told me he'd written a song about Howard Hughes that he performed a couple times, apparently. And when I asked him to, I told him, you got to play it for me then. If you're talking to a radio journalist and you tell me you've written a song, we're going to want you to share the song because it just makes for great tape. And he demurred. It didn't take much cajoling to get him to sing the song for me, and he went right into it.
Thank you, Howard, for leaving me something, but all I got was frustration, and I'll never live it down. Oh, how I wished you were still around. No, I don't care what the papers say. I didn't do anything wrong. I'll never see the millions you left me, but I know you sang my song. So thank you, Howard, for leaving me something. But all I got was frustration, and I'll never be the same. But I thank you just the same.
It's Melvin Dumar, who died of cancer in Pahrump, Nevada on December 9th. He was 74. Benjamin Bombard is one of the producers of our show. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.